Good morning. You're listening to the Local News Hour. I'm Michelle Deininger, sitting in for Leslie Thatcher. Local time is 8:06. We've got meteorologist Thomas Gaboy with ABC4 Weather on the phone. He's going to give some more in-depth detail on the weekend forecast. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning and happy Friday. Hope that today's off to a good start. And weather-wise, it's going to be a pretty good day. We'll see more haze. We'll see a little bit more smoke. So the air quality is still not the greatest, but we get mostly sunny skies for today. We'll also be breezy at times. But because of the dry conditions and the breezy conditions, there's also going to be an elevated fire weather risk today. So if anybody is going out today, that's something to keep in mind. Make sure that you avoid any burning. But like yesterday, daytime highs, they're going to be in the middle 70s in Park City with a daytime high of 76. And then tonight, it's going to be a mostly clear sky. We could start to see a few clouds work their way into tonight as overnight lows drop into the lower 50s, going to go with a low of 53 degrees in Park City. And something we've been talking about over the last few days is that changes will be on the way for this weekend, and we'll really start to see those changes tomorrow, where moisture will continue to move in, cloud coverage will continue to increase, and from Monday morning from Saturday morning into Saturday afternoon, the chance for showers and thunderstorms will begin to increase. By tomorrow afternoon, it'll be about a 60% chance for wet weather, so about a 2 in 3 rain chance, and showers and thunderstorms are going to be likely. Not a guarantee that we're going to find wet weather, but it's more likely than not tomorrow with a daytime high of 69 degrees. The rain chance will start to tail off as we move into tomorrow evening, still keeping about a 20% chance of rain through the overnight. Still going to be on the breezy side as overnight lows will be dropping to around 50 degrees Saturday night into Sunday morning. On our Sunday, we get predominantly dry skies, but it's going to be a breezy day because on Sunday, another system will be approaching from our northwest. Daytime high of 69 degrees, so looking at a mostly sunny sky, but clouds are expected to increase Sunday night into Monday morning as that second system moves in. That'll bring us a chance for showers. It's going to be breezy and maybe in the highest terrain late Sunday into early Monday. A few flakes can't be completely ruled out. Again, that's going to be in the higher elevation, even higher than Park City. But I wouldn't be completely surprised if we see that because Sunday night, the temperature will be heading for 36 degrees, while on Monday afternoon, the daytime high of 52. But we should get at least some sunshine throughout the day as that second system moves out. Then Monday night, the overnight low of 33 degrees in Park City could get very close to that freezing mark. So if anybody has any plants, you're going to have to keep a close eye on Monday night because you might have to cover up some of those plants. But by Tuesday, the temperature will start to moderate a little bit, a high of 64 degrees under a mostly sunny sky. Then it'll be in the upper 60s by the time we get into your Thursday, with overnight lows rebounding back into the 40s.
Thanks, Thomas. All sounds good. It is getting so cold so fast at night.
It sure is. And it's going to be really cold at night next week.
All right. Thanks.
You're welcome.
In the studio with us, we have Laura Smith, Executive Director of Mountain Trails. She's going to give us the report we need for the final weekend of summer. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, sure. Leaves are turning out there. It's becoming very pretty. I was up in Bonanza Flat yesterday, and I wanted just to say, you know, there's going to be a lot of leaf peepers out there, and if folks want to get up into the Bonanza Flat area, don't forget that we have the Transit to Trails program that's running right here in town in Park City. It'll take you up to any one of the 3 trailheads in the Bonanza Flat region. It's free. All you got to do is go make a reservation at Utah Open Lands, and they'll get you up there with a bike or just for a hike.
Great.
So, yeah, really cool program.
Such a good resource.
Right, for sure. Helps keep traffic off Guardsman Road. what else have we got? We're honing in on two major trail builds. The Mother Urban Trail is well
That's
underway.
A great name.
Yeah. We'll have to do a show on trail names one of these days.
That would be really cool.
It would be fun, huh? anyway, you can pick that up at Gravedigger and then ride that up. That is a directional up only for bikes. Hikers can go either way, but bikes are up only, which makes for a great quiet trail experience. Also takes some pressure off of the Jennies and Armstrong trails. And we also have Charlie's 9K to Mid Mountain Connector, and that is going through the Black Forest area. And so the guys are out there digging away, and hopefully both of these projects will be done this fall. So just in time for a couple of really good fall rides.
Yeah, so talking about taking pressure off the popular trails, how have the crowds been?
It seems like they've dissipated a little since school started again, but they are, as compared to, you know, pre-COVID, we still see a lot more people on the trails than we did prior to the pandemic. So
sure.
It's just a great safe place to be and enjoy nature. And
this is true. Do you want to tell us anything about Tour de Suds?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was great. We had the smoke cleared. The temperatures were cool. The trees are turning. It could not have been better. We had a record, not a record, but we had a sellout registration. So 400 people showed up in costumes and rode 7 miles straight uphill to the top of Guard Road, and or not Guard Road, but to the Guardsman Pass. And it was a fun event. We had some great sponsors take care of the suds at the bottom. And we look forward to this race every year. So thanks to Park Guides who came out and raced or partied with us.
That's great. Yeah. Now, was there anything else you wanted to say about the Sky Ridge Trails?
Yeah, I was just going to say, this is a great time of year with the temperatures cooling, and the trails out there are really dry. So as we get some moisture in our future, just remember that, you know, if it's sticking to your heels or your wheels, it's time to turn around. Sky Ridge Trails are not only e-mountain bike friendly, but they're also dry, and they offer some magnificent views across the Jordanelle and Heber Valley. So wonderful time to get out there and check out the Sky Ridge Trails.
It is going to be such a beautiful weekend. So as everybody's heading out to take advantage of the trails and the weather and the last weekend of summer, any advice for everybody who is trying to coexist with so many other people on the trails?
Sure.
Or at the trailheads?
Yeah. So a couple of things. The parking up in Bonanza Flat is crowded. That is why there is a transit to trails program. So if you get up there and there's no parking, do not park on the road. You will be ticketed and or towed. Mm. But I think the overriding idea is that we have 400 miles of trails, and there's plenty of space for everybody. We just need to spread out a little bit.
Just need to get along. All right, that is good info. Thank you very much, Laura. Have a great weekend.
Sure, you too.
Take care. On the phone with us right now, we've got Kim Carson, board chair for High Valley Transit. She's got an update on the local free ride service, which is still in its early stages. Good morning, Kim. Can you hear me okay?
Good morning, Michelle. Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Thanks.
Yes, I can hear you. Okay.
So let's get into it. When did you last meet?
We last met on August 26th. And we had a fairly light agenda that day. We had a speaker that was going to present her experience with Valley Ride, but she was unable to make it. And we reviewed our ridership and performance and had a demo on a new data generation program, and I know that's not technically correct, but it allows our staff to really dig deep into different aspects of ridership to help with future programming. And we'll have budget updates ongoing between now and the time that we adopt it in December. But early October, we should have a fairly complete picture of what our budget will be next year. There's no surprises. It'll be very similar to this year.
All right. Sounds good. Let's talk about what's going on right now. How's ridership? With school starting back up, there's got to be a lot of change in the trends.
Well, we haven't seen that yet. We've carried over 11,000 passengers with the Micro since, that was actually just during August. The average wait time for pickup was about 14 minutes. I think once we see September's numbers, we probably will see a change due to school being back in session. But I think you'll find kids are using the Micro system and bus the fixed route during the school time. I mean, they'll use it after school. Some possibly even if they're doing activities before school.
All right, that sounds good. I am curious how things are going with COVID regulations. anecdotally, it sounds like some people have reported some issues with wearing masks or not wearing masks. Is there something you want to let everybody know related to that?
Well, yes, I want to remind everybody that it is still an FDA requirement that people wear masks while on public transportation. And, you know, they're an enclosed vehicle, even the larger fixed route vehicles. So please respect your fellow riders and our drivers for both the micro and the fixed route. Nationwide, we're seeing an uptick in assaults on drivers. And I think that's just so incredibly unfortunate. Here in Park City, at least with High Valley Transit, we have not experienced physical assault on our drivers, but we have, the drivers have experienced some verbal assaults. In fact, I know yesterday morning there was a pretty significant one. So that's unfortunate. So I just ask people to please wear your masks and board on the rear doors, unless you do have a disability that you can communicate to the driver, and then they will allow your access and facilitate that access through the front doors.
All right, thanks for that. I'm sorry to hear that drivers are struggling. That's echoing an assault that happened at the hospital too, with hospital staff here recently.
You know, our drivers are just trying to help keep everybody safe.
So would you tell us a little bit about your smart signage that has just recently been installed at some of the transit hubs?
Yes, you may see these large signs, and it says SOOFA on it, S-O-O-F-A, and that doesn't stand for anything in particular. It just is the name that the company came up with, and I haven't had time yet to go out and try it myself. But it will be able to, they've been installed so far at the Canyons Transit Hub, the Kimball Junction Transit Center, and the Ecker Park and Ride. And you can check out real-time transit information, the various fixed route schedules. There's even community calendars. And the information is available in multiple languages, which I think is really cool.
Yep, definitely. All right, would you give us a little bit of a rundown for August numbers? Ridership, busy times, app users. Let's hear where things stand right now, if you have that in front of you.
Yes, but let me pull it up again real quick. So for, let's just look at, we get these reports weekly. So for the week of September 3rd to the 9th, we had almost 3,000 passengers, 2,766, and then the average distance that they rode was 3.54 miles, and that is for Micro and Valley Ride. And just a reminder, Valley Ride is our paratransit service that we provide, and we operate that in conjunction or in partnership with Park City Transit. If, for instance, if a rider in the Snyderville Basin needs to go to a destination within the Park City Transit zone, we will transport them there, and then Park City Transit will transport them back home to their destination, even though that may be in the Snyderville Basin and within High Valley Transit boundaries. And so people, I just want to also remind people that they may see a van within Park City limits, and it doesn't mean that the regular microservice services it within the Park City limits. That's not the case. If they try to get a ride within either from a destination in Park or from a location within Park City Transit's area, or to that area, it'll show that the ride is unavailable. So that's an important reminder. But in August, like I mentioned earlier, Micro carried over 11,000 passengers, and the average wait time for pickup was 14 minutes. And we do expect that to start dropping dramatically now that we'll be able to introduce multimodal trip planning within the HVT app. And that about 2 weeks ago, so I encourage people to try that. And the highest, the reason that will drop is because it will then connect people with a fixed route recommendation for their travel. So it won't be a door-to-door service with the micro. And that'll free up those micro vans then to be doing more of those final mile trips.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that sounds good. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you the status of the New York license plates while I've got you.
All right. Well, people can wave goodbye to those because since we finally have a physical address that has been accepted by the state, we will be getting those permanent Utah plates. So you should see those anytime.
So I recall hearing not too long ago that the backup was because of the DMV. They were behind in processing, but was it more like they couldn't process you until you had a physical address? Is that what it was?
You know, I'm not certain. I think that may have played a part, but I do understand that they are backed up. So I think it may have been a combination.
Okay, understood. Let's look ahead to what's coming. I'm going to mention that your name popped up on the Wasatch County Council meeting agenda, not your personal name. High Valley Transit popped up. And I think perhaps a lot of people are going to hope that means that service could extend to Heber and other areas of Wasatch County. What can you tell us about that?
Well, when I served on the Summit County Council, we had had meetings with both at the staff level and the council level with Wasatch County, talking about the need for some regional transit options. And, you know, they were very interested. They don't have any dedicated transit taxes in place at this time to provide, you know, necessary funding. But I know our staff is continuing to talk with them, and we hope to have more conversations soon on a Wasatch Council and High Valley Transit Board level soon. And we will also be working with MIDA and looking at their needs. I mean, that's within Wasatch County, but eventually we could have a separate agreement with them for services.
That is a lot of potential growth and expansion. Are there other things you want to talk about right now about what's coming up? Fixed route signage, have we touched on everything, or do you have some other things to mention that we're going to look forward to?
Certainly. We do have new permanent fixed route signage that will be coming soon, and I think people will appreciate that. We have delivery of two brand new clean diesel buses, new Flyers, that we ordered over the winter that we're excited to have come. We have the engineering and installation of a universal transit bus charger at Kimball Junction, which may not be too exciting to most of your listeners or riders, but it will mean more efficient charging available in the future for those electric buses. And we will be taking delivery of some additional buses next year in 2022. And then we will be having the installation of a temporary bus canopy at the Ecker Hill Park and Ride to help accommodate our winter transit operations until we have a permanent facility built. And just to be clear, the permanent facility will not be built there. It will be off of the 40 corridor near Home Depot on that property that is owned by Summit County. But I just want to let people know that that's coming. And then I do want to mention that High Valley Transit recognized one of our drivers, the fixed route bus drivers, Jacob Petty, for rendering aid to a man who had been in a pretty severe accident with his truck when he hit an elk. I mean, it deployed the airbag and he had to crawl out the window. And so the driver could, our bus driver, Jacob, recognized that this gentleman was in, you know, distress and stopped and called 911 and rendered aid until first responders were able to come. So we really appreciate him going above and beyond and recognizing a situation where somebody really needed some help. And we have also learned that the gentleman is okay. He had minor injuries.
That was going to be my next question. Wow, how fortunate that the driver was there and able to help. When was that?
I think it was just in the past week, just last week.
I'm glad that turned out okay. All right, well, that is a great rundown. Thank you very much. Is there anything else that we need to touch on?
No, if you haven't given the micro a try, I recommend you do so. Those that have tried it, I mean, we have worked through a few little glitches, and I think the service has improved dramatically, and we're just seeing wonderful ridership. So thank you to all those that are utilizing it. Help keep cars off the road.
All right. Thank you very much, Kim. Have a good day. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was Kim Carson, chair of the High Valley Transit Board. Jeff Slosher is a retired U.S. Army Major General who commanded the 101st Airborne Division for 33 months, including 15 months in combat in Afghanistan. In his 34-year Army career, he served in Afghanistan, Iraq, Kosovo, Albania, Kuwait, Haiti, Jordan, South Korea, and twice in Germany. He was the first Global War on Terrorism Planning Director in the Pentagon after 9/11 and the first Deputy Director at the National Counterterrorism Center for Strategic Operational Planning. He's also a part-time Parkite, dividing his time between Utah and Washington, D.C., where he works for a technology company. He's written a memoir. It's titled Marathon War, Leadership in Combat in Afghanistan, and he'll be in person for a book signing at Dolly's Books on Main Street September 25th. I spoke with him about the experiences that that inspired the book and his thoughts on the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. So welcome, and thanks so much for talking to us. And first of all, and above all, thank you for your service.
Well, thank you. I really do appreciate being on the show, Michelle.
You spent a long time on active duty.
I did, 34 years, and, you know, I had no intention of doing that. I entered the Army as a private right after college. I just enlisted, and I ended up serving all over the place, three different wars, and it's kind of like, yeah, join the Army and see the world.
You have seen a lot that most of us will never see and really can't imagine, no matter how many movies we watch or books we read. It is a unique perspective that you're sharing with this book that you've written. I thought it might be nice to start by having you tell us a little bit about your process writing the book. That's another thing people don't understand, is just how tough it is to write a book and complete it.
Yeah, what's interesting about this is unlike most soldiers, as you'd expect, I actually kept a journal, you know, throughout most of my adult life. And so while I was in Afghanistan for these 15 months, at night, very late or early in the morning, I would kind of, I even say this in the book, Marathon War, I say I gathered my thoughts and put them inside the book, inside the journal. I was rereading it, you know, years later after I retired, and it was just so striking that there were deeply personal moments in there, things that were heartrending, really, really tough. It makes you, you know, wanted to doubt your own humanity and your spirituality and everything like that. And then there was uplifting moments, and then there were incredibly crazy moments. You know, war can sometimes be funny and crazy and heartbreaking all at the same time. And I said, you know what, I'm going to start writing. And so the process, I timelined it. I started actually in 2013 and 2014. And it took me about 6 years to write it. And I wrote it in the evenings. As crazy as it sounds, I wrote it on an Apple iPad because I was doing a lot of travel for my second career. And then I, of course, had to find an agent. I found one that loved history. And then we had to find a publisher. We found one that loved history. And it also had to go through a one-year defense clearance because of the things that are talking about combat and intelligence services and things like that. So it didn't get ready until 2021. That's when we published it. A long, long 7 to 8 year process.
Congratulations on completing it.
That's what my family said. It's like, whoo, a collective sigh of relief, you know.
That's great. Certainly, this is such a timely moment to be having this book out there and talking about it. And I am going to be curious to hear your perspective on what is happening right now in Afghanistan. But I thought before that, maybe you could share something from your book, any particular moments from your time in Afghanistan that you might want to highlight?
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, I talk, the book actually was almost like a daily diary. In other words, I cover days by days. And you know, there's a lot of history in it. Afghanistan has been invaded by almost everybody that you could think of as an invader, from Alexander the Great in 323 BC. By the way, my headquarters was on the same land as his was, you know, 2,300 years later.
Oh, my goodness.
Then Genghis Khan, Tamerlane, it's right out of history books. Of course, the UK, the Brits, the Soviets, and then, of course, of us. But what I wanted to, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about is that I, every day, would fly from my headquarters on a Black Hawk helicopter and go out. We had over 100 outposts throughout the frontier, and that's what we called it, because we had the rough Hindu Kush Mountains in our area, as well as the frontier with Pakistan. And that's where the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were hiding, and they were attacking across the border. So I'd fly out there every day. So one day I picked up a journalist, and her name is Barbara Starr, and she was working, she still works for CNN as a military correspondent, and she had spent some time with some of my troops someplace else. And I picked her up, and I said, Barbara, we're going to go out into the border. It's dangerous. Do you still want to go? And she smiled and said, of course. And so we flew out towards a place that is a combat outpost, and there were actually two or three along the border. And as we were just about to land, because I wanted her to see just exactly what we were trying to do there, they started getting attacked and mortared and things of that nature. And so we diverted, and we went another 5 to 6 miles south to a different outpost. And she's just a smiling, and she's all happy and everything like that. And we landed totally unannounced at one of my outposts. They weren't expecting us because they thought we'd be up north. And we got down there, and it was being run by a young lieutenant and his sergeant. There was about 25 soldiers there, and that was all between them and the frontier frontier with Pakistan and the Taliban. There was nothing. It was just literally there, some sandbags, all that kind of good stuff. And she was just in having a great time. And what she did was she sat down and she really talked to my soldiers. She did an interview on top of a sandbag emplacement, and we were looking into the distance into the frontier. But the main part about it, and she told me this as we were flying back to our headquarters, was she said, you know, these young soldiers really represent America better than almost any of you generals do. She said, they're so brutally frank, they're honest, they tell you what they think. And she said, I just really, really enjoyed this. And I said, you know, it was also dangerous, Barbara. And she goes, yeah, but that's nothing. She said, my story is about your young soldiers. And that just hit me. No matter what we have going on in Afghanistan right now, no matter how unsuccessful we may think our policy has been or whatever, those young soldiers still, they're the same as if they were fighting in World War II, World War I. They still represent America better than probably any of us old, you know, general officers.
Something for everybody to think about, certainly. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
Coming up to present day, we've entered a new chapter in this conflict, and I wondered if you wanted to talk a little bit about what you see happening now with the Taliban.
You know, Michelle, one of the key things I write about in Marathon War is that there is a continuity that is required in a location as important as Afghanistan. And so I say, because I kind of predict this, even though the book was written a few years ago, that, you know, we can forget about Afghanistan. We can leave Afghanistan, but Afghanistan won't forget about us. And what I see out there as we currently look, and for all our listeners, I mean, you know, we are essentially 100% out of Afghanistan at this point. We don't have a diplomatic presence. We don't have any real intelligence presence, to be honest with you, and no military. But that doesn't mean that we can or should abandon Afghanistan, and clearly after the Afghan people. At the end of the day, I end the book, I really look hard and think about it in Marathon More, the final chapter, is, was this worth it? I lost 180 troops, soldiers, Marines, airmen, and sailors killed during my 15 months in command of them, and they were doing what I ordered them to do. So, you know, their deaths are constantly on my mind. Was it worth it? Yes, it was worth it in the sense that a generation of Americans and a generation of Afghans had a different life that would have been dramatically different if we hadn't gone in there. So for the U.S., for Americans, we have been essentially protected from a big attack from Al-Qaeda on my homeland for 2 decades. It's questionable whether that will remain now that we're not there. for the Afghans, we gave an entire generation of children, some who weren't even born in 9/11, but and then others that didn't remember it because they were 2 or 3 years old. That whole generation grew up thinking that human rights was something that they too, Afghans too, could have. Girls could go to school. Girls could become politicians and businesswomen, radio announcers, TV announcers, you name it, they are now. And this whole generation of hope for the Afghan people, it's going to keep us, we have to, you know, stay involved one way or the other, whether it's in Afghanistan itself, whether it's in this Afghan diaspora that we're seeing right now. But those people will constantly be concerned about their homeland and wanting to go back in and help one way or the other. And so what I would just say is, you know, we need to keep thinking of Afghanistan, even if we've decided to leave it in this way.
So speaking of how we're thinking about the Afghan people, I meant to ask you, did you get to know any Afghans?
Oh, yeah, many. In fact, I mean, one of the most heartrending things over the last month and a half is trying to help many of them get out. You know, I mean, I don't want to make any political statements, but in some cases, they felt like the U.S. government was not helping. It was too bureaucratic, or it was just impossible, given the way that we decided to leave in a rather hurried way. So trying to help those Afghans get out. Some I knew, some of them had worked for me, some I did not know. But they that the word had gotten out that, you know, I could help in one small way or another. But yeah, I mean, I got to know, well, some of them were very first senior. Bismillah Khan ended up being the Minister of Defense. He was the Army Chief while I was there, and we used to fly around Afghanistan together. It was funny listening to his broken English and my terrible, terrible posture, which I've done everything I can to, unfortunately, improve, but it's terrible. I mean, you know, all the way down to young soldiers that, for better or worse, I got to meet in the middle of really tough circumstances. Either they were laid out and they were wounded, and I was trying to, you know, help them one way or the other. I made a lot of Afghan friends.
So you've said that one of Afghanistan's biggest challenges now will be building an economy around something other than opium production, which apparently is right now what they are primarily financially dependent on. Do you have any thoughts on where they might go or what they could do?
Yeah, you know, well, while we were there, Michelle, what we tried to do is we actually tried to wean them off of opium. Poppy production, and the farmers had literally forgotten over 45 years of conflict and this massive influx of dollars to try to get opium. They had forgotten how to farm, and you know, you can't actually farm rice in the lowlands, the river valleys, wheat in the higher portions, pomegranates, things of that nature. But we were bringing in, and this is going to sound crazy to most Americans, but we were bringing in agricultural development teams from the Army National Guard, who were essentially farmers and soil specialists and things like that, and reteaching the Afghans how to farm their own land. That's one of the things they're going to have to do. Subsistence farming for the rural areas is going to be critical. If they can't do that, then it's going to be a real challenge. Mining is going to be another one, too. It's very rich, but the Chinese are going to be coming in there very quickly to try to get the rare earths and the minerals out of that country on their own.
Oh, that's interesting. So right now, with the withdrawal making headlines and being pretty hotly debated, I wonder if you want to speak to, looking back, what you see as any aspect of this conflict that we got right. You've already talked about that, the generation that grew up in a different reality than they would have otherwise. But conversely, do you look back and see any particular aspect of this that the U.S. should have handled differently?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and this is going to sound, there's friction here between what I've just already said about this next generation of Afghans, because I do think that that was extraordinarily important to give them the human rights and the possibilities, the education. And that required both medical hospitals to be built and schools to be built and then actually have school teachers. But what we tried to do in some cases is recreate another little America. And most policymakers, most military people like me, senior leaders are going to say, no, we didn't. But the truth is we tried. We don't even know we were doing this. When we roll up our sleeves and go into a country like this, we recreate, in some cases, our own country. We use an awful lot of money. We throw money at things to try to solve it. We believe that, you know, the whole world has a culture that understands that, you know, humans are very important rather than maybe not in some countries. And so what I think we did is we made a mistake in trying to do too much way too fast. And in many cases, we disempower tribal leaders, and it was a very tribal and remains a very tribal society. Same thing with elders. Elders are deeply respected there. And we tried to create a kind of westernized community of communities. And in many cases, it worked in some of the biggest cities. It didn't work in the rural areas, and it allowed the Taliban to come back in a way that surprised us.
All right, that is very interesting. I have a feeling that locals showing up to Dolly's to attend your book signing are going to probably have a lot of follow-up questions. We just have another minute. One thing I was curious about is, do you have another book in you?
I might, Michelle, but the one thing for everybody that is a prospective writer is writing is hard, but it can be cathartic. At least it was for me. Publicizing and getting the book out so that people can read it is equally hard and requires an awful lot of work. So I've got about another year of trying to do that on this book before I start on another. But yeah, I've got either books about Iraq or Kosovo, other wars, but potentially on PTSD. I'm deeply concerned about what I see about the soldiers that we are now leaving behind one way or the other, post-traumatic stress and suicide ideation, and I may write a book about that.
That sounds just as important. Well, I really appreciate your time. Thank you for all of your perspectives, and good luck with the book signing, and we will talk to you.
Michelle.
We'll talk to you again in the future.
Great, and I really appreciate you doing this, Michelle.
That was retired U.S. Army Major General Jeff Slosher, who will sign copies of his memoir, Marathon War, Leadership and Combat in Afghanistan, at Dolly's Books on Main Street, September 25th. We'll be right back after this. The Park City Community Foundation is accepting applications through the end of the month for its climate impact grants, which provide funding for projects that seek to reduce emissions or sequester carbon from the atmosphere. In 2020, the Park City Climate Fund distributed two rounds of grants totaling $385,000 to 11 recipients. In 2021, the Climate Fund will grant $250,000 to local organizations, businesses, or entrepreneurs, and the application process to receive a grant has just opened. I talked about the Climate Fund with Diego Zegara, Vice President of Equity and Impact for the Community Foundation. He explained what previous climate impact grants have achieved so far and what the Climate Fund Board is looking for from new applicants. Thanks for joining us. Glad to talk to you today. Why don't we start by having you tell us a little bit about how the Climate Fund came about?
Yeah, certainly. It was back in 2019, I would say, that a group of concerned citizens, community members, donors came together and started talking about what is it that our community can do to address the impending threat of climate change. And mountain towns can feel climate change in a very visceral way. We see it in our reduced snowpack. This summer, we saw it with wildfires threatening neighborhoods in our community. So this group of folks got together and launched the Park City Climate Fund with the idea of supporting organizations, individuals, and entities that would bring forth innovative ideas with funding. So in 2019, we led the first round of funding for the Park City Climate Fund in tandem with our community hosting an event for Mountain Towns 2030, a collective of mountain town communities that is coming together to address climate change. And that year, we received around 30 applications, and the committee funded three large projects between $50,000 and $75,000 with the hopes of having deep impact and with the idea that these projects and initiatives could scale. Last year, we led another round of funding with eight initiatives being funded. And to date, the Park City Climate Fund has supported these projects to the tune of $385,000.
All right. I think it's going to be fun to hear about some of the specifics of some of the projects that have come through already. And that will also give people listening an idea of what you're looking for as you go into looking for the next round of organizations and ideas that you're going to be granting funds to. Maybe just highlight one or two projects that sort of exemplify what you're looking for?
Certainly. The one that is very near and dear to my heart is the human-made beaver dams. It's a collaborative project between Wild Utah and Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Last year, they received a grant, and their project aimed to increase carbon sequestration by restoring wetlands. In a nutshell, what they do is they install these beaver dams, but they're human-constructed. These beaver dams restore creeks and riverbeds by diverting water onto the banks and re-soaking dried land. These conditions are excellent at sequestering carbon, also known as carbon sinks. I'd be remiss if I didn't point at Recycle Utah's effort as well, which are focused on outreach and community education towards the goal of zero waste by 2030. They designed a two-year plan to continue raising awareness about the issue, and they're talking about landfills. It takes all these projects working in tandem, carbon sequestration, as well as emissions reduction and community outreach and education. So they are working on a multi-sector collaboration to hire a specialist, a zero waste specialist that lives at Recycle Utah. And they're working in tandem with government, the business sector, and residents to identify how they can reduce their emissions.
Mm-hmm. So Swanner Eco Center and Recycle Utah, both well-established, professionally run organizations. Are there individuals who have gotten climate fund grants as well with more entrepreneurial ideas or without the network of an entire established organization?
Yeah, no, there's certainly smaller groups and smaller grants. A 2020 grantee received $15,000. They are Ecology Bridge, and they are working on the removal of garlic mustard weed, a noxious weed that renders toxic conditions in the soil. They are trying to eliminate the plant and bring local soils to a healthier level of microbial activity. So, no, it's not just the large organizations that are receiving funding, but smaller entities can participate as well. And honestly, this year, the committee is looking for innovative ideas. Perhaps someone's working in their garage on the next big thing, and the committee is interested in looking at it, and if it has the potential to scale and reduce emissions or sequester carbon, they would be interested in funding that.
So deadline to apply for the next round of grants is October 1st, is that correct?
October 1 is when we will have the application process open until, yes, and folks can apply until midnight.
So going back to you looking for innovative ideas, are there categories of this work that are rising up to the top of the list as most desperately needed ideas in this category, and maybe other categories kind of got that one covered for now?
It's hard to say, and I think it varies by individual. Some folks are really into the emission reduction and technologies that can help us get there. And also, it's hard to isolate. We have to think about carbon sequestration at the same time. What we are doing is thinking more intentionally about the measurement and evaluation piece, and how is it that we can calculate the amount of carbon that has been sequestered by a project, by an initiative. So we are being a lot more intentional about tracking the impact these projects can have, because at the end of the day, we want to be able to share these with other communities as well.
I had been wondering whether emissions reduction as a category was more pressing than carbon sequestration or the other way around. So it sounds like neither is more important than the other.
Yeah, I would say that they're both extremely important, and there can be really innovative ideas and projects that can produce meaningful outcomes under both those categories.
And so what you're saying that you're looking for with people applying and their innovative ideas are things that lend themselves to accurate and meaningful data collection and impact collection, if that's a term?
Yeah, yeah. We want to We want to be able to let our community know that these projects are working, and if so, which are the ones that are most meaningfully sequestering carbon and reducing carbon emissions.
Well, one thing that I know the Community Foundation has talked about in conjunction with working with Mountain Towns 2030 is scalability. Do you have an example of maybe a past grant recipient and how they have worked to scale their project and share knowledge with other mountain towns?
This year, we are being more intentional about reporting out on previous grantees, and folks can go to our website to see the projects that have been previously funded. Because of COVID, I think that we haven't been able to look at that closely, but we are just now ramping up those efforts and considering which are those initiatives that we can leverage and scale.
All right, so we will send people to the website to read up on past recipients and the projects that they have received the grant money for and how that work is going. Your application process is open until October 1st. People should go to the website to get more information about how they can apply. How many applications have you gotten so far?
I think we've mostly had inquiries. I want to say it's in the single digits still, but we expect somewhere in the 20 for applications. We've received, I want to say, around 30 year one and around 25 last year. So that's kind of what we're expecting for this year as well.
How many did you award last year? Was it 11?
Eight.
Eight. Okay. So
3 in year one, 8 in year two.
Okay. And you got about 25 applicants. So people have a pretty good chance of being funded if they get their application in.
That's a good question. I think that this year the committee doesn't want to, let's say, they don't want to restrict big ideas, and we're encouraging folks to come to the table with large innovative projects. So it could end up being that there's fewer high impact grants that the committee leans towards, or it could happen like last year that there were more smaller grants. Year one was an example of fewer high impact grants. Year two was a larger grant number and smaller amounts, but it really varies depending on the year.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's just kind of, it depends on what the applications have in them.
And we don't want to put a cap on the size of the idea. So folks should come to the table and dream big.
Do you want to talk about why it's so important for us in mountain towns to be coming up with these ideas and making these changes? I think most people would point to how much we love our skiing. And of course, that's a linchpin of our economy as well. So you can say there's an economic reason to lessen climate impacts to protect our snow.
Right. So you just said it. Environmental issues are directly tied to economic outcomes in mountain towns. And it feels like we are well positioned to pilot ideas and be the testing ground for some of these innovative projects. The idea behind Mountain Towns 2030 is that then we can then help translate those results into easily digestible information for other communities to deploy successful programs and projects. And we're lucky that we have the leadership of Chris Steinkamp, who's driving the Climate Solutions Project, and inspired by Drawdown, really looking at what is it that we can pilot, launch, and then scale so that others are also successful in reducing their carbon emissions to net zero, which is a goal that we're starting to see across the nation.
And people who might have not necessarily been paying attention before, especially people in the West, we got hit hard this summer with smoke, and that was a very tangible aspect of our lives that was inescapable. The air quality is dangerous, and it's coming from wildfires. I wonder if that drove home some of these concepts that might just not resonate with people automatically.
I think it brings it to the forefront. The wildfires, the ensuing smoke, our inability to enjoy the outdoors fully as a result of climate change has been palpable this summer more than ever. And I think that makes the Park City Climate Fund more critical than ever as well. And we're seeing that in the level of support, in the level of interest, and I'm really curious and excited about the grants that will come in.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. Hope you get a lot of good projects.
I appreciate you. Thank you so much for everything you do.
That was Diego Zegara, Vice President of Equity and Impact for the Park City Community Foundation. For more information about applying for a climate fund grant, visit the Community Foundation's website at parkcitycf.org.